This evening we're looking at Isaiah chapter 46 through 48, and we will be finishing the section of Isaiah that runs from chapter 40 through 48. It's the section that we've described as prophecies concerning the coming deliverance. In chapter 40 and verse 1, the word comfort is the theme of chapters 40 through 48, that God is going to comfort his people. There will be deliverance in the future. So tonight we want to finish this section that runs from chapter 40 through 48. And there are some themes that run through these chapters. One is that, of course, the coming deliverance. The other is that God is great and powerful, and that idols are nothing. And there is a comparison and a contrast all throughout these chapters on the vanity of idolatry and following the one true God. And it's God who is going to bring about this coming deliverance. And so what people are left in the days of Isaiah that are worshiping idols, they need to quit that and they need to come to the one true God. The very last verse of this section, chapter 48, verse 22, sums it up well. God's people who trust in him, they're going to be redeemed, but the wicked will have no peace. And that really is a good summary to this thought about following idolatry. If you're going to continue in that wicked idolatry, there is going to be no peace for you. So let's start this evening, and let's look at this last section then. Matthew, we'll start with you. Chapter 46 is primarily about idolatry, and specifically the idolatry that would be found in Babylon. Number one, what are carried on beasts, and what do they do to those who carry them? Right. And who are or what are Bel and Nebo? Matthew?
There are two specific idols of Babylon.
Right. And Babylon just had hundreds of them, just like other cultures. And so don't just think that there were two. There were many, many, many. And we've got an image that I want to show you in just a minute. But they would even not just carry the idols on the animals, but they would mark the idols, mark the animals with a moon shape, as we're going to see in just a moment. So in verses 1 and 2, you have these people in Babylon, and of course, some Israelites were idolaters, and they're carrying around these idols on their beasts. But look at the idea, they're carrying a heavy burden. These idols weigh a lot. But in contrast to that, what does the Lord do for his people? Pat?
He carries them and delivers them.
Okay, so see the contrast there. Man carries idols that aren't real, but God carries his people. He supports them. He cares for them. And that's a beautiful comparison there. So in verses 3 through 7, we have a contrast. The idols are a load on people. They're a burden. But God carries his own people. The Lord asked his people why they like him to an idol. Those who make idols bow down to them and worship. They carry them on their shoulders. They cry to them, but idols do not answer and they do not save. And so it's a contrast between false gods and the one true God. And in verse 5, to whom will you liken me? And that question is asked in different ways throughout this section. Why are you trying to make me like this physical object? I am much greater. I sit above the circle of the earth. And all of these passages on how that God creates the heavens and the earth, several of them through these chapters. Don't bring me down to the level of a piece of stone or wood or silver or gold. Okay, so there's a contrast here. And so the Lord carries his people. He will bear them. And that's a beautiful thought. I will bear, yea, I will carry and will deliver. Okay, Larry, number 3. What question does the Lord ask? Exactly. And it's a question about why are you going to try to make me like one of these idols? And Eric, number four, what do those who make idols do with their idols?
They lavish gold out of the bag and weigh the silver in the balance. They hire a goldsmith and make it a god. They prostrate themselves as worship and bear on their shoulders and carry it and set it in place. And it stands and will not move.
Right. They try to worship them, carry them about. They try to cry unto them for help, but they do not save or they do not deliver. Joyce, number five, what does the Lord do to show that He is God and there is none else like Him?
He tells them to remember the past and that He predicts what will happen through His prophets.
Exactly. And I've mentioned this before in our previous class, that word declare or proclaim is a theme that runs all throughout these chapters. It shows that God is a real God. He will declare it ahead of time, and some of the declarations are very specific. Chapter 44, the very last verse, Cyrus is mentioned by name 150 years before it happens. And as we're going to see in tonight's lesson, the reason God does that is so that when it comes about, they can't say, "My idols have done this." And he's trying to anticipate what these worldly idolatrous Israelites are going to say. "Oh, I prayed to my idol, and that's what brought about such and such." God says, "No, I'm telling you ahead of time so that you can know that I did it and not these idols." Okay? And one specific thing that he mentions here, look at verse 11, calling a ravenous bird from the east. That is a reference to Cyrus, if you want to make a note there. And we made mention that Cyrus is mentioned by name in our last lesson, but there's also verses here and there that continue the thought all the way up into chapter 48 and verse 14. So Cyrus is this ravenous bird from the east who's going to come and do God's counsel and will. Number six, Jake, who does the Lord call?
Isn't that what you're just referring to?
Yes. Okay, I forgot I had a question on that. So this ravenous bird from the east is Cyrus, and he's going to do the Lord's counsel and the Lord's purpose. Okay, Mason, how are the Lord's people contrasted with the Lord Himself? Okay. They're far from righteousness. He's going to proclaim righteousness. He is righteous. So there's a contrast there. 46 verses 8 through 11, the Lord shows that He is the only God by declaring things to come. He calls a ravenous bird from the east, Cyrus, to fulfill His counsel and His purpose. Verses 12 and 13, the idol makers. And notice this thought here. In verse 12, "Hearken unto me, you stout-hearted." Look at verse 8. "Bring it again to mind, O you transgressors." Verse 3, "Hearken unto me, O house of Jacob." He's referencing these idol makers. And they make their idols, verse 3 through 7. They're transgressors, verse 8. They are stout-hearted and far from righteousness, verse 12. Okay. The idol makers are transgressors, verse 8. They're far from righteousness, verse 12. In contrast, the Lord brings righteousness and salvation to Israel for His glory. So it's a contrast there between idol makers and the one true God. Okay? So let's look at chapter 47 now. Sherry, number 8, what is the Lord going to do to Babylon?
Destroy
the victim. Okay. God is using Babylon to punish His own people. But then He's going to turn around and punish Babylon, and we'll see why in chapter 47. But before we do that, this is a small section on the side of a bowl, a clay bowl, that was found in the temple of the moon god at Babylon when there were some excavations being done. And this little dotted part was missing. It's been filled in. But all of this part was there. And the interesting thing to notice about this is they worship the moon and the sun and various other heavenly beings, bodies, as we're going to see in chapter 47, the astrologers and so forth. And they would actually imprint the moon on the head of a bull, like a brand, like a brand. And so this idea of idolatry being even imprinted on their bulls or pottery, showing the, you know, stars, sun, moon, clouds, these celestial beings, and then bulls that were used to sacrifice to them and so forth. And that is a very interesting find right there. Just a artist drawing of what is actually on that piece of pottery. So it was very, very common in this day in Babylon, and then unfortunately the Israelites did it as well. So what is God going to do to Babylon? He's going to bring her down. She was known as the daughter of the Chaldee, just a very popular nation, tender and delicate, verse 1. But she's going to be brought down to shame. God is going to execute his vengeance on her. Okay? Why is the Lord going to do this? This is an interesting thing. Number 9, Matthew, why is the Lord going to take vengeance upon Babylon? Right. The Lord takes vengeance upon Babylon. She's going to be judged for her cruelty to God's people and her pride. And we're going to get into some other things about her in verse 8. But thou didst show them no mercy upon the aged that thou hast heavily laid thy yoke. And so she is proud. She is cruel. And so God is going to punish Babylon. And he'll use the Medo-Persians, Cyrus and the Medo-Persians to do that. Daniel chapter 5 and so forth. Okay. So it doesn't matter what nation you are. You still need to act properly in the sight of God. And when you don't, you're going to be judged. And we saw earlier in the book of Isaiah, Isaiah 13, along in there, the just entire chapters against Babylon. Okay? Number 10. Pat, how is Babylon described and what is going to happen to her people? Right. Right. So she's given to pleasure. There's immorality. She's proud. There, you know, who is it like me? I shall not sit as a widow. Nothing's going to happen to me. Nobody's going to take anything from me. So they're proud. She also follows the counsel of sorcerers. She trusts in wickedness and human wisdom. She's going to be made desolate because of these things. And even in the very next paragraph, let's go ahead and take that. There's more that is said about this matter you know, the sorcery and the astrology and so forth. Larry, number 10, I'm sorry, number 11. What does Babylon trust in and what is going to come unto her people? Okay, and I'm sorry for the misnumbering there. The next one, number 12, who do the people of Babylon turn to for salvation, Eric?
Their enchantments and sorceries, and they shall fall upon you, and desolation shall come upon you suddenly.
Right, and notice in verse 9, there's an emphasis on sorcery. Verse 10, human wisdom. They had people who would come in and give counsel to the king. And it was human wisdom, and it was the worship of celestial bodies. They would turn to verse 13, astrologers. Don't confuse astrology with astronomy. Astronomy is a good science. Astrology is a pseudoscience. Astrology is looking at the alignment of the heavenly bodies, the planets, and other things in order to try to get some bearing for what is going to happen in my life. And so they were getting their guidance from looking up at the stars. To prognosticate, that comes from a Greek word, literally, pro ahead and gnosis, to know ahead, to try to know things in advance, or we would just say predict the future and so forth. And it was all based upon the worship of the heavenly beings and so forth. In Genesis chapter 1, why did God give the celestial bodies? For signs and seasons, for chronology and things like that, but not for for determining time and how long do we know, a month, for example, a full moon and things like that. But it's not given for guidance, wisdom, direction in life and learning how to live. It's not for that at all. But astrologers, literally the Hebrew word is diviners of the heavens. That's something completely man-made. And so these people are trusting in these kind of individuals, but they're like stubble. They're going to burn. They cannot deliver or save. Okay. Joyce, how does Isaiah describe the house of Jacob? Okay, so they're hypocritical. So we'll look at that in just a minute. But before we do that, number three under the digging deeper, what great city in New Testament times is compared to Babylon? Rome in the book of Revelation. And I just wanted to mention this. Many times in the New Testament, and a lot of them are in the book of Revelation, there's a reference to Babylon. But in Revelation, it's symbolic of someone who is powerful, but also very immoral. And notice in these places, and these are all of them in the book of Revelation where Babylon is mentioned, it's either going to emphasize her greatness or her immorality. Revelation 14:8, fallen is Babylon the Great, that hath made all nations to drink the wine of her wrath, of her fornication. It's coming from chapters like Isaiah 47, where Babylon was known for pleasure and immorality. The great city was divided into three parts, and Babylon the Great was remembered in the sight of God, 16:19. 17:5, the mother of the harlots and of the abominations of the earth. 18:2, fallen is Babylon the Great and has become a habitation of demons, a hold of every unclean spirit, a hold of every unclean and hateful bird. Some of that in there would probably include idolatry too. 18:10, the great city Babylon, the strong city. 18:21, the great city cast down and so forth. So Rome is compared to fallen is Babylon, but its power, its greatness, but then also its immorality. And you can get more details, for example, in Revelation 17 and 18 about the immorality. But I wanted to put that in here to remind us that Babylon then becomes symbolic in the New Testament of power and immorality. Okay, back to chapter 48 now. We've got Jacob or Israel, those among them who are hypocritical. They swear by the name of Jehovah, but not in truth and righteousness. They say, I follow the Lord. I swear by the Lord. The Lord this and the Lord that. But in their life, they're not carrying out that. They're not living in God's truth. They're not righteous. They're engaged in idolatry and other kinds of things. And so it's just a hypocrisy. And we've got to be careful about that today in our own lives. Okay. Jake, number 13. What does the Lord do to stubborn and rebellious Israel, and why does he do it? Right. He tells them that things are going to happen ahead of time. Verse 5, I have declared it to you from old. Before it came to pass, I showed it to you, lest you should say, mine idol hath done them, and my graven image and my molten image have commanded them. I'm telling you things in advance with regard to Cyrus and other things, so that you don't go back later and say, well, my idol did it. Idols are nothing. They can't do anything like that. I can. And that's why I'm declaring this ahead of time. Verse 4, I know that you are obstinate, you're rebellious, you're hard-headed. Verse 8, thou heardest not and knewest not, yea, from old your ear was open, for I knew that you dealt treacherously and was called a transgressor. So I know that you're like this, but I'm telling you in advance so that you can know later that I did it and not your idols. And I guess one thing you might get from that is that because they're rebellious, verse 4, obstinate, hard-headed, later on, no matter what is done, they're still going to give credit to their idols. If you want to worship idols bad enough, you're going to stick to it all the way to the end. You know, and some of them did. They wouldn't come back to God. Okay. Mason. Number 14. Why does the Lord not completely cut off Israel?
He says that it's for my own sake and for my own praise that he's going to restrain his anger.
Right. There will be a remnant. God will save some. He's not going to utterly wipe them out. And he's going to do that for his own namesake, his own glory, his own praise. He wants Israel and even the world to know that he's a loving, gracious God, and he will save those who repent and come to him. He's not going to utterly wipe them out. So the house of Jacob or Israel is hypocritical. They swear by the name of the Lord, but not in truth or in righteousness. The Lord knows that his people are obstinate or hard-headed. He declares things to come in the future so they will not say their idols have done it. These people are treacherous transgressors. But the Lord does not completely cut them off. He restrains his anger toward them for his own namesake, praise, and glory. Okay. Sherry, how does the Lord describe himself to Israel?
The first and the last.
The first and the last. And this has shown up other places in the book. We've seen it recently, I believe 41:4, 43:10. 46:4, different places. I am the first and the last. Okay. It's a contrast between he as the one true God and false idols. And then again in verse 13, I have laid the foundation of the earth. Continuing these verses on creation. Okay. Number 16, Matthew. What does the Lord want his people to assemble and hear concerning Babylon? Right. So the Lord is the first and the last. He creates the earth and the heavens. The Lord calls Cyrus to perform the Lord's pleasure against Babylon. Basically, Cyrus is going to do two things. In doing that, he's going to conquer Babylon and he's going to allow God's people to return. But in doing that, he is carrying out the Lord's pleasure. So verse 14 is another reference to Cyrus. It runs from the last verse of 44 all the way through 48. And Pat, number 17, what does the Lord desire for his people whom he teaches and leads? Right, he just wants them to hearken. He teaches them and leads them. He wants his people to obey his commandments, but for a purpose. It's not just to be doing it, so that they can have peace and righteousness and a blessed offspring. He wants them to be rewarded. He wants us to be rewarded. That's why we need to obey his commandments. It's not just to give us busy work in life, just something to do to be doing it. It's so that we can have these things that come along with obedience. And then, last of all, Larry, what happens to Israel after their days in Babylon, and what happens to the wicked? Right. And so remember this theme of chapter 40 through 48, deliverance. And so those who are righteous, those who are God-fearing, following God, even if they have to go into Babylon in captivity, they'll be able to return and their God will provide for them, like providing water in a desert, verse 21. But if you're going to remain wicked, there's just going to be no peace for you. So those are your choices. Okay. Let's look at a few things by way of summary. Some things that we've seen over the past few chapters. One is Cyrus. If you look back to chapter 44 and verse 28 and 45 and verse 1, he's mentioned by name. And the whole point of this is so that God can declare it in advance so that the people can know that he is the one true God. And you can imagine God's people reading Isaiah in the days of Ezra. And when King Cyrus said, y'all can come back, they're going to know that, oh yeah, I remember Isaiah saying that. Or I remember my parents talking about what Isaiah wrote. And this guy's named Cyrus and he's letting us come back. And so that would have been very faith building. So he rebuilds Jerusalem and the temple, but he's also mentioned in the chapters that follow. He's going to subdue nations. He's going to build the Lord's city and let the exiles go free. He's described as a ravenous bird because he's going to conquer Babylon. And on the night in October 539, where they're partying and carrying on, Belshazzar's having this drunken party. They divert the water of the Tigris River and they just walk under the walls of Babylon because part of the walls were built over the river. Very smart. They just walk in, take the city. Now, they didn't do that in one day, but they just took the city. And so it's a ravenous bird, but he's going to perform the Lord's pleasure on Babylon. What is that? Well, as we saw tonight in chapter 47, she showed no mercy. She was immoral. She was proud. And so she needs to be punished. So see that as you go through. Another theme, and I just got started on this. I had a couple of charts built. I've left out a few. But go back through and look at all of the references to God is a creator. This is a beautiful portion of Isaiah. It should be faith building for us. It should be one thing that we're missing today is people are not being taught the greatness of God and how He created all things. Some don't even know about the one true God. But we might call it Isaiah's apologetic. What did he use to get people to have faith in God instead of idols? He came back over and over again to this idea of God as a creator. Who hath measured the waters in the hollow of his hand and meted out the heaven with a span and comprehended the dust of the earth in a measure and weighed the mountains in a scale and hills in a balance? 40:12. 40:22. It is he that sits above the circle of the earth, and the inhabitants thereof are as grasshoppers, that stretcheth out the heavens as a curtain and spreads them out as a tent to dwell in. 40:26. Lift up your eyes on high. See who hath created these things that bring out their host by number. The reference to the stars. He calls them all by name, by the greatness of his might, and for his strong, that he is strong in power, not one is lacking. So each one of these teaches us different things about God. 40:28, hast thou not known, hast thou not heard, the everlasting God Jehovah, the creator of the ends of the earth, faint not, neither is weary, there is no searching of his understanding. I forgot to put the reference here. Thus saith God Jehovah that created the heavens and stretcheth them forth. He spreadeth abroad the earth and that which cometh out of it. He that gives breath unto the people upon it. That's a very important aspect right there. The Hebrew writer says in chapter 12 that he is the father of our spirits. Gives breath unto the people upon it and spirit to them that walk therein. So our mom and dad give us our biological, physical body, but every time there's a conception, God gives that individual a spirit. That's pretty impressive. Our parents give us the physical makeup of things, but God gives the spirit of each person that is born. That's impressive. 44:24, thus says Jehovah, thy Redeemer, he that formed thee from the womb, I am Jehovah that make all things, that stretches forth the heavens alone, that spreads abroad the earth. Have you noticed how many times there is mention of the heavens and stretched them forth, stretches forth the heavens? If you go back, you'll find this statement different times. What was it that the Babylonians were worshiping and some of the Israelites? the stars and the celestial bodies up in the heavens. So Isaiah, he's not running from that. He's not trying to ignore what's up in the sky. He's saying, look up there. That's my point. God made all of that. That's not something to be worshipped. God made that, and you need to worship God. But it's God who makes all of this and has the understanding. You don't get your direction in life by looking at the stars. You get your direction in life by looking at the one who made the stars. That's where you get your direction. And that's one thing that Isaiah is trying to get them to see in this. 45:7, I form the light and create darkness. I make peace, create evil. By the way, some people wonder about that. That word evil in the Old Testament is used in a context like this to mean not sinful evil, but like judgment on people and things of that nature. I am Jehovah that doeth all these things. 45:12, I made the earth and created man upon it. I, even my hands, have stretched out the heavens, and all their host have I commanded. So Isaiah is saying, all of these things that you're worshiping up there, God made those, and you need to be worshiping Him. And then 45:18, thus saith Jehovah that created the heavens, the God that formed the earth and made it, that established it and created it, not a waste, that formed it to be inhabited. Genesis 1:1, the earth was waste and void, which just simply meant uninhabited. And then God made man and so forth. So look at those things. Those are very important kinds of things. And there's still some more that I need to add to that chart coming on up to chapter 48 with regard to his creation.
That first reference is 42:5.
42:5. Okay, thank you. I'll go back and add that in. 42:5. Okay. Let's look at our digging deeper before we close this evening. I'm sorry, our applications. We need to turn to God because idols do not save. In 1 Thessalonians 1:9, the people of Thessalonica turned to God from idols. And people today need to do the same thing if they're worshiping those idols or putting their trust in idols. Idols do not save. God does, and we need to turn to Him. Number two, sometimes the Lord's people can be far from righteousness. That's an interesting way of expressing that. You that are far from righteousness. Where are we at with regard to righteousness? How close are we to serving God, or are we far away? Okay. Any nation who is given to pleasure, pride, wickedness, and following their own wisdom is going to fall. And so we have this Rome in the book of Revelation. Fallen is Babylon. Well, why did Rome fall? For the same reason that Babylon fell. Pride and immorality and so forth. We should not use astrology to find guidance for our life. Did anybody find anything they wanted to share? On number four in the digging deeper, what do astrologers do? Does anybody want to share anything on that you found? All it is just pure made up speculation. There's nothing to it. And so people are very serious about, you know, the horoscope and getting the newspaper. Oh, yeah. Very serious about that. In Galatians chapter 5 and verse 20, one of the aspects of sorcery, it's a work of the flesh, one of the aspects of sorcery had to do with, you know, divination, and maybe not necessarily of the heavenly bodies, but it's all grouped together in determining things for your life in ways other than God's word. It could be taking a kidney out of an animal and seeing the shape of a kidney. The ancient Babylonians did that. Assyrians did that kind of thing. Or it might be looking up into the heavens, or it might be, a pot of something, and when you pull something up out of the pot, how it's in the bowl. Just a bunch of, you know, we would say nonsense, but some people are very serious about that kind of thing, and they've been told a lie about that. And we saw in a previous lesson where Israel is described as those who are deceived and so forth. People who worship idols, it's a lie to them. There's a deception. And so people, some have been given over to that. And we don't turn to that for our guidance in life. We turn to God. And you can go pay, you know, you go visit the astrologer, you pay money, and or the tarot card reader, or whatever it is. And people are very much, some are very much into that. And what would be nice is if they would put all of that energy into reading their Bible and letting God guide them. Wouldn't that be great? Number five, we need to be careful not to be hypocrites by making mention of God while not living in truth or righteousness. Turn with me to Titus 1:16. So they were swearing by the name of Jehovah, but not in truth or righteousness. And so, you know, let's claim to be a Christian. Let's tell others that we are a Christian. Let's tell others that we follow Christ, but let's back that up in our life as well. Titus 1:16, they profess that they know God, but by their works they deny Him, being abominable and disobedient unto every good work, a reprobate. And, you know, Jesus gave scathing rebukes toward the Jewish leaders for being hypocritical in similar kinds of ways. So we've got to be very careful about that. Okay? Number six, the Lord wants His people to obey His commandments when He teaches them. Pretty simple, and yet it's something that we need to be reminded of over and over again. Jesus said on more than one occasion,